You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Before this episode of the Final Word Podcast, a quick thank you to the Final Word sponsor, Brick Lane Brewing. Thanks for supporting our friends at Brick Lane Brewing. Hit them up on Instagram, Brick Lane Brewing. Have you seen their 2021 release, Trilogy of Fear? Oh, it looks intense. I don't even know what it is, but I know this. It's a limited release, so head to bricklanebrewing.com to check it out. I like to think Trilogy of Fear is the exact opposite of Brick Lane's One Love Pale Ale, the yin and yang of beverages, thanks to Brick Lane. Sort of like Adam and Jeff, the yin and yang of cricket writers, broadcasters, and podcasters. I don't know if that makes sense, but you get the idea. Brick Lane Brewing and The Final Word, one of the all-time great partnerships. Make sure you join Adam and Jeff on the Final Word Patreon page. If you support the show, you could win a slab of Brick Lane goodness. Adam and Jeff will tell you more about it in the show. And remember, you can find everything Final Word related at finalwordcricket.com. Thank you, Brick Lane Brewing, for being part of The Final Word, and thank you for listening. That's enough from me. Now, Adam Collins, Jeff Lemon, and The Final Word.
I had to go about it, write it out, and find it myself. And there's some stories I can tell you.
This is The Final Word. Story time. The cricket show where we go back through the past, the history, the distant history, the not-so-distant history, sometimes the present, sometimes the future. I'm Jeff Lemon. The other one's Adam Collins. You might as well hear him now. Here he is. Round of applause.
Hello. How are you?
Feeling good. I'm feeling primed. This is story time 56, the big 5-6. It's a milestone in some cultures, I'm sure.
It's an Olympic year in Melbourne, the first Olympics held in the Southern Hemisphere. I suppose there's that question, if you had a time machine, you can go anywhere mm-hmm. with it, where would you go?
Yeah.
I think we might have discussed this on the show once before and identified the centenary test match at Melbourne for us as our kind of peak revisit, but
yeah.
Given we're talking Olympics, I'd be somewhere at the 56 games, I reckon, from a Melbourne perspective. I'd love to have been in the glasshouse a year after it had opened, watching mm-hmm. the swimming there or perhaps at the track with Betty Cuthbert, something like that.
That just sneaks in because at that point you'd be able to pop down the road and see Howard Florey. My cutoff for the time travel has always been that it has to be after the advent of penicillin. Because I'm pretty sure I'd die within days if I were anywhere where I couldn't access antibiotics.
Remember the Sliders episode when they go back to a parallel universe when they don't have penicillin and mm-hmm. Maximilian Arturo invents penicillin for that particular world that they're in? This will come up in our Sliders recap podcast that we make when we, at some stage, I was going to say when we stop making The Final Word, it'll probably run parallel to The Final Word in keeping with the idea of parallel universes. It'll be cricket a couple of times a week. It'll be Sliders maybe once a fortnight, something like that.
Yeah, you can just punch the numbers on the magic Sliders remote control and be transported into a parallel world in which we're not cricket podcasters, we're Sliders podcasters. if we can get Gerry O'Connell to play in a cricket match with us, that will be the peak crossover of the, you know, if we can put on stage a game with it, like a Final Word listener game, but get big JOC to come and play.
There won't be anything left to achieve in this world.
He's quite responsive on social media. Like, I've seen him engage with Sliders fans on there before. Okay. There's a couple of Sliders fan Twitter accounts, which I follow, of course, and have engaged with us a little bit, haven't they, when we've talked about it on our show, and people have tagged them in. And Jerry O'Connell's quite good with them. So I see no reason why if we started this Sliders podcast, I suspect he'll come on at some stage, and then we're away. We can explain to him about our parallel universe and how we'd love him to slide through to the cricket world with us through the wormhole and join us on the park. It could happen, you know. We've had people discussing on our Discord page that when the Olympic Games are in Los Angeles in 2028, and in all probability cricket will be there based on what we're hearing from the ICC in recent months, that we should go to America and all be there for it. Well, maybe Jerry could be with us there for it as well.
And as I've said, that would be it. That would be the peak. And then Alexander wept, for there were no more worlds left to conquer. also in keeping with the Sliders theme, how many worlds there are. The vaccine game will probably come around too soon for Jerry O'Connell, I feel, but we do have lots of people putting their hands up to you're going to try to get some teams together of people immunised with the different strains of vaccine so we can see which one has made better cricketers.
Yeah, so Declan Lawler, who we've been following very closely, he's Pfizer, but he wishes to maybe play, maybe umpire, maybe score, but he will not run. He will be no one's runner after the Thames Track fundraiser a couple of weeks ago. We'll come to that in a sec, actually. But yeah, we've had one other offer. Well, no, I wouldn't call it so much an offer, but a conversation that started. I'm in negotiations with the Oval Dream Boys, who I've played for this season, it must be said. So it's not as though it's a fierce negotiation, but we are looking at a date, maybe the 17th of September. So it might be less a vaccine game and maybe perhaps a final word game against the Oval Dream Boys. And I like that because ODB, DOB, Dusty Old Bastard, Oval Dream Boys, it all kind of works for me.
Yeah.
A number of friends of the final word will be playing for them if we can pull it off. So watch this space on that front. But yes, hoping we can end the English summer with a game, including final word listeners, somewhere, somehow. And I'm going to insist that you are vaccinated at the very least. maybe we won't break it up by vaccination, but you must get a jab to play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No jab, no play.
No jab, no play. You can have one at the ground before
if
the
required.
Game.
If it takes that, we'll do that.
It'll give you a dead arm, I'll warn you, for a few days. Declan Lawler is, of course, the gentleman who ran the Thames or tried to run the Thames. The Thames conquered him in the end. Declan's lost two toenails, he's let us know, since having to call off halfway through a run of having already done about 160 odd miles in 2 days. His feet were buggered and he couldn't keep going. He got a letter from the Lords Tavs having sent them all of the fund-raised cash, and Declan said the letter made his mum cry. He was very moved to get this letter thanking him for what he'd done. They raised about £2,500 to send through to the Lords Taverners, which is a pretty special effort for someone to do, literally with his blood, sweat and tears, you know. Like, a la Mo Sizlak, do you know how much my blood, sweat and tears are in these drinks? That was not a figure of speech in Declan's case.
No, it wasn't. So, yeah, that was a nice postscript there that the Tabs wrote to him during the week. He sent us a DM with that letter, which was lovely. And puts a nice full stop on that fundraising effort. If he's inspired you, let us know. If you want to do something later in the summer over here, or in Australia for that matter. I know that as different states come out of lockdown, you might feel that the want and need to do something in the great outdoors. Well, you can raise some money for some kids living with disability or kids in disadvantage through the Lords Tavs, who we're proud to be associated with. But yes, all at lordstaverners.org. But let us know if you want to not necessarily follow in Declan's footsteps literally, but yes, figuratively, and do something for the Tavs. That'd be lovely.
It is easy to do literally because they're bloody and probably seared into the footpath. It'd be quite easy to follow in Declan's footsteps. You could also not injure yourself and just give them the money. Personally, I would rather pay them a couple of £1,000 if it meant I didn't have to run the length of the Thames. That would be a far superior arrangement as far as I can see. So everyone approaches things in different ways, as we've discovered through the course of this show.
Jeff, we're going to approach a few numbers in a few different ways here, I suspect, on a little game that we call
Nerd Pledge. Pledge. Nerd Pledge. It is the game of nerds, the game of pledges, the game where we get quizzed, the reverse quiz. The audience asks us questions and we have to try to work them out. They do this by supporting the show because in order to make the show, we need to put lots of time into the show, which means it needs to kind of become a job. And so it sort of does because people on the Patreon page send us an amount of currency, but they send us a really specific amount, a cricket amount. An amount where the number relates to cricket, and we have to work out what the relationship is. For instance, now this one's an exception because normally someone wouldn't say send you £2 flat. They might send you £2.53. But in this case, we have got £2 flat because 200 is the pledge number. Gareth the Surrey Badger. So that tells us a lot, Gareth, in the way you've chosen to portray yourself there, that we can see that Gareth is very nerdy about cricket and particularly about Surrey cricket and has sent us 200 as a number for some reason, having been in correspondence with you, Adam.
Yes, he has. So this had to go to you, Jeff, because Gareth had already basically told me what this was going to be. So I sort of fed you a couple of clues and steered you in the right direction about it being, you know, Surrey, but not Surrey, for instance, and knowing that it would take you some time to work through it, but safe in the knowledge that it is still a professional cricketer playing at the moment. So yep. Gareth also wants us to do a little tail enders crossover at some stage as a podcast. I don't think we'll do that, but the aforementioned vaccine game with the Oval Dream Boys has got a strong tail enders link, shall we say. So one thing at a time, but let's start with Gareth's pledge, Jeff.
Well, as it happens, we do have a tail enders crossover because we've got Felix White from that show on our show next week, I think. He's got a new book out, which is a bloody brilliant read, actually. It's a really beautiful book. I've had the pleasure of reading all of it, and we're going to speak to Felix about that. So that's coming up. But right, this clue. Now, so what I had from Adam was this Beyoncé-style clue, as in Surrey, I'm not Surrey, then that it's relating to a current player. And so I sort of went back and forth with Adam asking leading questions. I was like, I'm going to assume this relates to either Rory Burns or Dom Sibley, because Rory Burns is the Surrey guy and Dom Sibley used to play for Surrey. Mm. And Adam sort of said, yeah, that's, you know, that would be fair to assume something like that. And then I was like, all right, Surrey but not Surrey means some kind of age group cricket or second 11 or something like that. And he went, yep, that might not be a bad place to look. So actually, I hadn't had the pleasure until this week of using whatever it's called, the sort of UK version of My Cricket, where you can really get into players like club scores and stuff. So I went back to Banstead Cricket Club, where Rory Burns did a fair bit of his early work. No 200s for Rory Burns. I figured if we're looking at these two, we're looking at batting scores. As far as I can tell, has only made one double hundred in his whole career at any level of cricket, which was in first-class cricket for Surrey, for the senior team. Across all of his Banstead stuff, 154 not out was his highest score. I don't entirely trust this website, though, Adam, because I was looking at his list of scores, and apparently on the 6th of May 1990, Rory Burns played an innings for Banstead where he was dismissed for naught. Didn't have any not outs in that season in 1990. May the 6th, 1990. Now, the trouble with this is that Rory Burns was born on August the 26th, 1990. So apparently he played a match for Banstead while still in utero, which is probably reasonable that he didn't make any runs. You know, if you are still a blob, then you probably will score a blob. But elsewhere in the numbers, there were no double hundreds. Dominic Sibley made a few double hundreds in his version of this sort of level of cricket. He played for a team called Ashted or Ashteed. I'm not sure which way you would go with that, but let's say Ashted in the Surrey like Premier Cricket. I'm not sure of the name of the competition, but whatever their Championship Premier League or something like that. And that's where he played a fair bit of his junior cricket. So he made a 220 and a 224, and he really had it in for a particular team called Weybridge. So in 2017, he took 2 for 48 and then made 127 not out to win a single innings match against them. The year before that, got out cheaply against Weybridge, but turned it on, took 3 for 28 with the ball and bowled them out 22 runs short. Those were as a young adult, but then you go back a number of years to 2011, He made exactly 200 runs from 218 balls opening the batting, took them to 306, and he was 15 years old at the time. And they were very excited about this at Ashted because his father and his grandfather had also played for the club, and they were thinking, oh, big things for this kid. Well, what do you know? He became a test player from Ashted CC. And that, I believe, is very badgery, is very Surrey, is very Sibley. You know how I feel about Dominic Sibley's batting if you listen to this show. 200, I believe, was when he had a day out. 200 from 218 balls. Didn't hang around when he was 15. Bring back that Dom Sibley, that's what I say.
Yes, it is, and I can confirm for you, because I know this to be true, that you did get that correct. So well yes. done, Jeff, and thank you, Gareth, for starting off the show with a nice nerdy one. 401 is next up from Evan mm-hmm. Granger. Jeff, we have a clue as well.
Yes, at test level, says Evan, a victim of poor timing. At first class level, one of the pioneers. 401.
Jeff, I wouldn't normally do this for something that's not a cap number, but nevertheless, cue the music, DC. Jeff, I saw the opportunity this week to roll out Dusty Old Bastard, but in a slightly different way. For Harry Ginger Lee wasn't the 401st Test cricketer for England. Mm. However, he's a man with bad timing in many respects, and he was a pioneering all-rounder, a right-handed batsman and a right-arm seamer who also bowled off-spin. So I would say funky-esque ahead of his time.
And you spoke to me about Ginger Lee not that long ago, didn't you?
I did. And that kind of helps inform why I think this might be what Evan's steering mm-hmm. us to, because the pledge came in around the same time that I was talking about it recently, but in a slightly different way. So, I mean, Ginger Lee's story is a cracker. So he's born in Marylebone, you know, within spitting distance of Lords. He grows up the son of a greengrocer, playing the game on the streets of Marylebone with a light post for stumps. I mean, it's a beautiful story. Ends up on the ground staff at Lords in 1906 when he's a boy, and then finally makes it sort of onto the staff by 1911. By this stage, he's 21 years of age. You press fast forward to 1914, a fairly significant year in modern human history. That's just when he's making
it. Happened.
A bit happened.
Yeah, a bit was going on.
A bit was going on, including for Ginger Lee, who makes 139, his first big breakthrough innings for Middlesex, and that's 2 weeks after the war's been declared. So that's the sort of end of his season, and that's kind of it. In September 1914, he does as many, many professional cricketers did at that stage and enlisted in the army. And unfortunately, and this is the bit we focused on last time, he was shot and assumed dead and left for 3 days in no man's land in France. So he was between lines for 3 days, ended up a prisoner of war, got repatriated to the UK in 1916. I didn't know that happened, Jeff. This was something that was... I thought that if you were a POW, that was kind of your lot until the end of the conflict. I didn't know that they did repatriations during a war. I mean, you studied this before when you were doing your masters.
Yeah, it was... The way you're thinking of it was the case in the Second World War. That was much more hostile in that sense, in that the entire continent was occupied and there were no transfers. And, yeah, once you were in Stalag Luft 3, you were pretty much there for the duration or until you tried to break out. But the First World War, because it was so static, at least on the Western Front, there wasn't really an advantage to keeping prisoners, particularly prisoners who had already been injured or something like that. It was more a drain on resources than anything else. So, yeah, if you could arrange trades, there was a fair bit of that went on.
Right. And in this case with Ginger Lee, his leg was stuffed. I mean, they nearly blew his leg off, so they thought that there was no point keeping him. But it wasn't as stuffed as they thought. It was withered and it was smaller. But by 1917, he's back sort of playing sport again. And in 1919, when first-class cricket returns, he's back in the team in Middlesex to have his first of 13,000-run seasons. In 1920, he's part of that famous Middlesex team that win the championship on the final day of the season at Lords against Surrey. He made a century there. He was in that top four that dominated sort of like few others post-war. I think there were two instances where the top four all made centuries, and he was part of that both times. And, you know, he's a serious cricketer. So he's going through the 20s and making loads and loads of runs. runs, but he's thought of as an ugly player, so he doesn't get these England opportunities at all. In fact, he's completely overlooked through the 20s, despite how prolific he is. A number of double centuries, you know, he has a top score of 243 not out. He's a consistent wicket taker as well, a genuine all-rounder. He could be picked for either discipline, but it takes until he goes to South Africa as a coach in 1930-31, and this was the part of the story we picked up on in great depth last time we touched on Ginger Lee, where he got his one test match as a 41-year-old, didn't do that well in Johannesburg, made 18 and won in a draw, but he was only picked because there was a bout of illness through Percy Chapman's team, and they had to call for anyone who was in the area who could play cricket, and they had this guy from Middlesex who, of course, could play a bit, even if he was perhaps just a little bit past his best. But yeah, they were all crocs. He came in, didn't quite work out, and as we discussed, he wasn't given an MCC cap and blazer because they felt that he acted dishonourably by leaving his coaching job in South Africa in order to represent the MCC, which is an absolute disgrace. Anyway, so he plays his one test match, again a victim of bad timing per the initial clue given there by Evan as far as his test career is concerned. He keeps on keeping on. In 1933 against Somerset, he is playing for one team and his two brothers are playing for the other. So it's Harry, Court Frank, Bull Jack, which is the only time in first class cricket three brothers have been involved in the same dismissal. He retired in 1934 and took over the youth setup. Didn't take long before he was on the field again though. He umpired between 1935 and the war. When his career ended, it read that he had taken 390 first class wickets, but posthumously this was updated to 401 first-class wickets. I have no idea where they found the other 11, but that's our number. 401 first-class wickets at 30 and 38 centuries. Originally, he finished his first-class career, or so he thought, with 20,007 runs. So let him go past that milestone. That was later adjusted to 20,158 runs at an average of 30 as well. So 30 with the bat, 30 with the ball, 38 centuries, and he was never far away from the stands there. He used to sit beneath the scorer's box, beneath Father Time there in the mound stand until very late into his life. When he eventually passed away in 1981, he was England's oldest living test cricketer, or he was until he passed away. So he was a controversial figure in many respects. He had a quick tongue on him. He used to cause a lot of grief for captains and all the rest of it because of that sort of disposition. But he was a fine player, and yes, he certainly meets the criteria of being a victim of poor timing and a pioneer as a first-class all-rounder. Evan Granger, I've got for you Harry Ginger Lee, dusty old bastard.
Ginger Lee. It does sound like someone who would have a quick tongue with that sort of name. Speaking of oldest players, shout out to Eileen Ash, still going at 109. What a boss.
We've got to get her on. We have to get Eileen Ash on the final word at some point. That's on me, actually. You know what I'll do? I'll ask Claire Connor to see whether she can arrange to get Eileen to join us on the show at some stage.
Yeah, 109 not. You definitely need a round of applause. You can salute with every single addition to that score. You can raise the bat at that point. So, all right, Harry Ginger Lee, the 401 for Evan Granger. Thanks, Evan. Next one from Michael Edelstein, $8.80. Very nice, Michael. Thank you. Now, when I see a number like this, obviously I think, Is there a bowling analysis that matches up to that? There's not, at least in a test innings sense. There is in a test match sense in terms of match figures. And I really liked 8 for 80 as match figures because this is royalty. This is the best of the best. There are only 5 of them. Sobers, Lily, 2 Imran Khans, and then Sean Pollock. You know, that's a decent 5, and I reckon Sean Pollock could be pretty happy to be in there with Sobers, Lily, Imran times 2.
That's a good question. I mean, where do they? I mean, if you were doing a depth chart on the 4 of them, you could make a compelling case, perhaps for all 4 of them being the most important cricketers, like certainly in their generation for their country. There's that period where Imran, and Andy Zaltzman has this stat, where there's like a 30-game period where he averages 13 with the ball or something ridiculous, and no one's had a better average, excluding Ferris and Lohman and the pre-1900 guys. There's no one from that point on that has a better run in Test cricket, full stop. Over a period that long, that's right. So when people think of Imran Khan as the great all-rounder, they sometimes perhaps forget that he was an absolutely generational fast bowler, in addition to being an incredibly good player as well with the bat.
Yeah, and as a captain and in the field. Well, I suspect you'd find that Ferris and so on wouldn't have actually played that many test matches. They wouldn't have a streak that long. So, to do that over the course of, say, 30 matches is extraordinary. So the two out of those that I would most draw attention to, there's Lilly in the first test of the 81 Ashes, the Trent Bridge match, where, you know, obviously England end up winning that Ashes 3-1, the Botham series and all the rest of it. But Australia win this really tense match on a very wet green seamer in the first test when it's swinging around a lot. Lilly gets Gooch, Woolmer, Gower in the first innings and then picks up 5 for not many in the second, sets Australia up to chase 132, which they get. But an even better one is the Sobers one. This is Headingley 66, in which Sobers comes out with West Indies batting first, bangs out 176, batting at number 6, takes the team to 500 and declares, and then puts his bowling boots on and takes 5 for 41. Like, you'd just be so demoralised if one player was doing that against you. Makes a follow-on, picks up another 3 for 39, and that's his match. The West Indies have won 3 of their last 4 tours to England at that point, and Sobers has that magic series where he has 300s, 250s, averages over 100, picks up 20 wickets, and wins all 5 tosses just to rub it in.
Blimey, that's outstanding. Thanks again, Michael, for that pledge of 80. We really do appreciate it. Next up today, Jeff, is Jai Singh with a pledge of 120.
120. There is a clue from Jai as well. He says he's obviously tapped into our love for Indian royalty. The clue is a Nawab had a second wind. Happy hunting.
Yeah, so, I mean, I started with Tiger Patowdy. I just kind of thought maybe... Yeah. I mean, we've talked about the Nawab of Patowdy quite a bit, but I thought his son, this could have something to do with him. We had a bit of a
steer. Well, also happy hunting. I mean, tiger hunting.
Yeah, sorry, yes, the tiger hunting thing.
All that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and that was picked up on... I actually put this onto the Discord channel. We have a Discord channel for Nerd Pledge Numbers, and I thought, I'll just see. I was trying to groupthink the answer necessarily, but if there was a good thread there, I would have told that story. And, yeah, we thought maybe after his title was removed, it could be to do with that second coming, but that didn't really sort of line up, so... Instead, we went back to Virender Sehwag, who was known in his playing career as the Nawab of Najafgarh. Now, in November 2012, Sehwag wasn't going so well. He'd made just one half century in the past year across 10 attempts, so the worst run he'd ever had in international cricket, in Test cricket. And he was starting a new series against England at home where he was under genuine pressure for his spot for what, Jeff? I guess the first time in a decade or thereabouts since he burst onto the scene in the early 2000s. And then, bang, by lunch with Goutam Gambhir riding shotgun, he'd taken India to 120 without loss at Ahmedabad. Sehwag had 76 from 66 on the first morning of a test match. I mean, he went on with it at a slightly slower strike rate thereafter to complete his innings on 117 from 117, which is still altogether absurd. While England come back and eventually win that series 2-1, a very influential series in English cricket, and Sehwag only really goes on to one more series against Australia. He did have that one special day when he got his breath back and made it to 120 without loss with 79 from 66 on the first morning.
I like that because, yes, he was the Nawab. That does involve a second wind. I'm still thinking about that happy hunting bit and whether there's a clue there as well, but I think that's a very good first bid. And Jai Singh, the beauty of it is if that's not the correct answer, you just send us a message, a DM on the Patreon page. You let us know, give us another clue to move us closer towards your answer, and we'll do it as a revisit, as we'll do in the second bit of this show. Our next number, it's from Steve Stevens. Why have two names when one name will do? Steve Stevens, $1.88, and Steve has done a number on us with this one. This is
he really has. I mean, there's a clue and there's another clue and there's another clue, and we'll have to go through the clue, I think, Jeff, in order to work this out. But let's start it here. This nerd pledge relates to a cricketer that I did a 180 on during their career, but especially when they retired. It does require some simple mathematics, especially as there is quite a bit to this player. Now, why don't I read each clue, and Jeff, you can express what you've done from there, and we'll kind of piece this thing together. that work for you?
Yeah, okay. I can let you know how I approached this. All right, you read the first couple of bits.
Okay, so the part one was find their first landmark test score as well as their second landmark test score and add them up. Let's call that result A. Now, mm-hmm. find their test bowling average and multiply this by result A. Let's call this result B. So okay. where have you started with those first two clues?
So what I did, because I'll add in the third bit here, which is then you divide result B by the player's position in the test captains of their country. That's result C. And at this stage, I was like, okay, I need a spreadsheet. There's only one thing to do here, and that is make a spreadsheet. And I thought, all right, Steve Stevens, pledging in dollars, I'm going to guess you're Australian, so I'm going to put a list of all the Australian test captains with their captaincy numbers mm-hmm. in the sheet. Then I'm going to collect their bowling averages and put all of those in the sheet. And then I'm going to have to manually work out which are their first two important scores. And then I set up a formula so that it would add the two scores, divide it, multiply it by the bowling average, and then it also had to divide it by the captaincy number, and then I think divide that by 100. So I set up some formulas so that I could then auto-populate the sheet by punching in the data. Once I put the scores in, then it would spit out the result for me. So goodness, that's what me. I've done for you, Steve. That's what goodness I spent a bit of today.
All right, so we've got, okay, so step us through the maths then. I mean, from there, we're, you know, as you say, dividing result B by the player's position in the test captains. Next, yep. you divide result C by 100. Of course, we should call that result D. So talk us through the sums yep. and the actual numbers you've gone to.
Yeah, and then we take the first two decimal points of result D, like the first three numbers, and that's the number, that's the 188 that Steve is going for. So algebraically, if I were trying to get to 188 and I knew one other value, then I'd be able to try to work out a third value that way, but I only had one value, so there was no way to do that, to sort of reverse engineer that. But there was also the conjecture about what does landmark mean, because to me, I often call a half century a minor milestone. That's sort of one of my go-tos in text sometimes. And so is a 50 a landmark score? Because it's still a landmark. You still raise the bat. Or does it have yeah. to be 100 to be a landmark score? So is it a player's first century and half century, or does it have yeah. to be their first 200s?
I would say, I mean, personally, I wouldn't call a maiden half century a landmark. Mm-hmm. I mean, that wouldn't be a word I'd go to. I would use landmark for three mm-hmm. figures, arbitrary as it may be. I yep. think that, yeah, that's what I would personally go with.
Yep. So what it meant is first I populated all the fields with the first two 50-plus scores, and then I went through to
did it again.
Only hundreds because it didn't work for the 50s. So, yeah, there was a fair bit of labour went into this one. And here is where I ended up. Shane Robert Watson. So started off with a lot of 50s. That's why I didn't get this initially. He went 78, 62, 53, 51, and then had that streak we talked about, I think just last week, when he made 96, then 89, then 93, then got dropped on 97 and managed to get his first 100, then got out for 97 in the innings following. But the 100 that he did make was 120 not out. And a couple of tests later in Mohali, the magic place for Australian cricket, he made 126 there.
Yes.
And that was his highest score to date. Okay, add those together, that's 246. Multiply that by his bowling average of 33.68, it'll take you to 8,285. Divide that by his test captaincy number of 44, also attained in Mohali 4 years later in 2013. That gets you to 188.301, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Divide that by 100 and take the first two decimals and you get 1.88, $1.88, the pledge of Steve squared.
Oh, Steve, that's very, very good. I've just noticed something in all of this, Jeff. Mm-hmm. Shane Robert Watson, SRW, SRW, Stephen Roger Waugh. They've got the same initials.
Wow.
Never even crossed my mind through following Watto's career. Steve, you're a wonder. That's exceptional work. On one hand, I don't want to encourage other pledges like that because that is going that's never going to compute for me. I just don't have the brain for that kind of thing. And I know how long that takes, Jeff. On the other hand, It just happens to be that you are the number that's been drawn out of the hat this week for the case of beer for the Brick Lane slab, the One Love Pale Ale, Jeff. Mm-hmm. So Steve will get a voucher for that, but I don't want one to come to the conclusion that the more elaborate the pledge, the more likely you are to win the beer. This is purely drawn out of the new numbers that we have on the show each weekend. So this is correlation, not causation.
This is purely drawn from how thirsty I am after solving that clue. that it made me think of beer. But yes, it will not necessarily be the case that if you make a sweat, we will give you the reward. But Steve gets to give someone a reward because he gets to give away a slab. He can give it away to himself. He can give it away to anybody else. Brick Lane are doing a very good line in pale ales. Let me tell you about this one, Adam.
Please do.
Did you know it's golden straw in colour? Did that cross your mind?
I do, because I'm looking at the can right now. I mean, I said this to you last week. What I would give to tuck into one of these right now, it looks... I mean, I think in the modern... The way that beer is now sold, packaging means a great deal. I mean, whether it should or shouldn't, that's not for me to say, but it does, and this looks great.
I also noticed a couple of our listeners worked out that Brick Lane are making these limited edition, like, very heavy Belgian-style beers as well that are about
8%
and look pretty dangerous.
This.
So there's a fair bit of stuff in their stable, but this one I've had the pale ale. It's very pleasant. It's very sort of easy drinking. Malted and flaked wheat in the brew, we're told. Flavors of grapefruit, passion fruit, and stone fruit.
Yum!
So many fruits. Yeah, it was very very summery, very refreshing, and 24 of the best shells of that will be making their way to you, Steve Stevens.
I went to a brewery in Hanoi a couple of years ago where we found the passion fruit beer, Rach and I, and we were enjoying that the whole way through. So that's just inspiring me yet further, knowing that there is the passion fruit and the stone fruit and the citrus flavours and all the rest of it. So yes, the Brick Lane brewing community is one that we're really happy to be part of, not least because it's from the southeast suburbs of Melbourne, where I hail from. I think, Jeff, the fact that they have not only been a really good local employer, but also they're really committed to the technology they're using to ensure that their beer is made in an environmentally friendly way, it ticks a lot of boxes for us, and it's been great having them on board, and I hope you enjoy the slab that's coming your way, Steve Stevens.
One more new number to go. It's Jesse G back once again to the well. You cannot keep Jesse G down. $6.49 is the number. No hints from Jesse G. Open canvas for you, Adam. Where did you go with $6.49?
Well, first of all, I had a look at some sort of inning scores, and then I realised I was going to junk this off because 6.49 is the score from perhaps the worst test match we've covered, Jeff, which was the Sydney test of 2018, the final Ashes test, where it was hot, it was disgusting, it was illness riddled. I mean, Jeff, you ended up in hospital yourself.
Yeah,
through
the test was so bad that I went to hospital on day two and still managed to file reports on the next 4 days.
I remember you filed one piece when you were genuinely off your chops. I mean, you were hallucinating. I went to drop something past the apartment you were staying at in Paddington, and I remember thinking to myself, like, he needs to go to hospital now. And you did go to hospital later that night. And then Joe Root joined you there, didn't he? From memory, you're at the same hospital Root rocked in at before
That's
day
right.
five.
Yeah, it was the ER at St Vincent's, and he was in there on the morning of day five, and I'd gone in on the night of day four, I think. So I wrote my day four piece from a hospital bed in the emergency room.
Commitment to the cause. But yeah, 6.49 for seven was the score that Australia made against England when, you know, this is one of the great advertisements for having the World Test Championship points count for the end of a series, because this was the most dead of dead rubbers. Anyway, happier times. The start of the next Ashes series at Birmingham in 2019, which started on this day 2 years ago, Jeff, the first of August, which I just thought, like, let's take this opportunity to reflect on what a lovely week in our lives that was. The first week of the 2019 Ashes gave us a chance to be really excited about what was coming post-World Cup, post-Women's Ashes. We were there doing work that we loved. We were there making our first YouTube video, the Holy Ground mockumentary that we made with Cam Fink, who joined us the day before the test match. From a personal perspective, it was the week that we got the 12-week scan for Winnie. So after stumps on day one, when Smith makes that incredible 100, I mean, you wrote your piece from the hospital in the fifth Ashes test of 2018. I had to I had like an hour and a half on the train back from Birmingham to London at Stumps in order to make sure I got home so I could go to the hospital with Rach in the morning, do the scan, be very excited about that, and get back to Edgbaston by about half an hour into the second session. So I had to be back at the ground, so jetted straight back up. And then that night, Rory Burns makes his 100, and then, I mean, from a personal perspective, it was the ability to show everybody the photo of the scan and tell everybody, as is the custom after 12 weeks, that you're going to be a dad. So that was a really great night. And you get to the fifth day, and that's when Nathan Lyon takes his 6 for 49. So I wonder whether this is what Jesse might be talking about. It was really important for Lyon to bowl out England, I reckon, on that day. I mean, the jitters he had early in his career in the fourth innings had since subsided. So, of course, the first 19 times that Lyon had the chance to bowl in the fourth innings after his debut, only 24 wickets came at a strike rate of 78. So he carried his reputation around for the first, I suppose, 3.5 years of his test career, that he wasn't the man for the job on the fifth day when he had to bowl a team out. That all changed in Adelaide in 2014, as we know, when he took 7 wickets and sort of held his nerve against Kohli and bowled them out late when the test looked more or less lost. And from that point forward, everything turned around. So in 19 fourth innings between Adelaide 14 and Edgbaston 19, he took 40 wickets at 29 at a strike rate of 52. So far more in keeping with what you sort of expect from a spinner on the final day. And on that particular day, he gets Jason Roy running down the track. He pulls level with Dennis Lilly's 355 test wickets along the way, which I think from memory was the fourth most or equal fourth most for Australia in test cricket, maybe equal third most, something like that.
Yeah, it's only McGrath and Warner ahead.
McGrath and Warner ahead of Lyon, that's right, yeah. Yeah, he picked up Denley and Root before lunch to kind of change the game. He got Stokes, he got Moen Ali. Yeah, and by the time he was done, 6 for 49 was his analysis. He was the match winner on the final day. Australia go 1-0 up in a test match where they were 90 runs behind on the first innings after Steve Smith's twin tons. And yeah, it was a wonderful way to start the series, not from a parochial perspective, but just the fact that we had a super competitive test where, you know, you were kind of thinking that this could be a classic. And it didn't quite get there, but there were moments when you combine what happened at Edgbaston, the Ben Stokes Jofra Archer show at Lords, and what happened with Steve Smith, you know, the Leeds comeback and Ben Stokes again. There were some amazing moments in the first few weeks of that series. And yeah, looking back at it, to think it's 2 years ago, I just can't wait till we can start experiencing those kind of moments again with everyone together and not having to worry about COVID. And hopefully that'll come, I don't know, maybe later this year.
I like it, Adam. Personal, professional, narrative, statistical. You've got everything in there. And I think it was a classic. I think that there were so many classic moments in that series that even though, yes, that fifth test match could have been set up a little better with the scoreline, but I think it was one of the more memorable series that there have been. Right. That's the end of the new numbers. If you want to play Nerd Pledge, it's very easy. You go to patreon.com/thefinalword. You can set your amount. You can set the frequency with which you want it to go. You have full control over all of that. It doesn't need to break the bank. You can join up and become part of that little fun community and then jump on the chat pages and so on with everybody else who's in there having a good time talking about extremely nerdy cricket things. And in doing so, you can help us keep making the show. Everyone is a winner. So drop by the Patreon page if you'd like to get involved. We'll take the mid-show breather, then we're going to look at the numbers we didn't get right from previous weeks and that we've got to look at again, and the ones we did get right before we wrap up.
Hi, I'm Dave Warner and you're listening to The Final Word.
Jeff, when I started high school, my favourite television show was The Panel. It was made by Working Dog. It was made by the people that had made Frontline, but here they were, not as actors, not as writers, but as themselves. And I would plug in on a Wednesday or a Thursday night, depending on which year and which season was being made, and really luxuriate in that current affairs conversation with great special guests. Well, I'm not saying that we're doing a reboot of that, but thanks to the Guardian Live program, I am sitting on a panel next week that'll also have 5 people on it, and I'm quite excited about it, and you can be there too.
You are in many ways, and it has been said for some time, the Kate Langbrook of The Guardian. that is, That is something I've heard before and probably something I'll hear again. And so that's the sort of the role you'll be playing in bringing conversational gambits to the fore on this panel. It is going to be a very entertaining conversation. So Emma John is on there, who obviously if you read The Guardian, you'll know who Emma is, one of the foremost writers on the game. Felicity Ward is on there, who is extremely wrong, extremely bad taste at times, and extremely funny. We both did a bit of podcast recording with Flick Ward in that 2019 summer with the Ashes and the World Cup, and she was an absolute riot. I've never known anyone to be funnier about their own pregnancy. That was definitely a high point, where her online game through that 9 months of like, what the hell is happening to my body, was extremely good. And then
and it's continued too, by the way. I mean, since she's been a mum, I mean, I think in some respects, sort of talking with Felicity at different points over the last year and a half or 2 years, or whatever it's been, she was initially pregnant when Rach was pregnant at the same time. So she's probably 3 months ahead of in the process, and watching the way in which, as you say, she documented that was absolutely brilliant. She also has had a podcast on cricket with Andy Zaltzman on the ABC. So she loves and knows the game, and yeah, it'll be great fun working with her again.
Taha Hashim is on there, one of the brightest young journalists coming through, and Atif Nawaz, who's also a comedian and doing a lot of good work in broadcasting cricket at the moment. So the five of them, they're all hanging out on this panel. It's really going to be a UK people time slot, because I think it'll be early hours of the morning in Australia. So unless you're a night owl like me, you might not be up for it. But if you're in the UK particularly, it'll be 7 p.m. UK time. It's on Monday, the 2nd of August. It's £5 to book yourself in. And you just go to the Guardian's website for the Guardian Live program. That's where they put on a whole series of these panels. So there are other ones as well that'll be coming up that you might want to look at. You can go there direct at gu.com/Guardian Live, or just punch Guardian Live into Google. You'll find it. And that is coming up on the 2nd of August with those five.
The one thing I might have missed there is that it's an online panel, so you don't need to actually rock up to an event in the UK. It's all there. I've jumped on the platform and done a bit of testing. It's all quite user-friendly. So you'll see all of our friendly faces staring back at you. I think Emma's chairing the panel for about 45 minutes and then half an hour of Q&A. We'll be mostly looking at it's sort of the midway point of the summer, isn't it? We'll look back at what's happened, and we'll look forward to especially the England-India test matches, which will begin later in that week, indeed 2 days after that panel chat. So I'm looking forward to it. You can join us for £5, gu.com/Guardian Live. It's all in the show notes. Monday night, be there.
Hi, I'm Brian Roddle. You're listening to The Final Word with Jeff Lemon and Adam Collins.
This is The Final Word. Story time, the revisits, the ones we didn't get right in previous weeks. And now this was crafty from Danish Babar. The number was $1.30. I gave a few different options, looking at Archie Jackson, looking at Warren Bardsley, Sean Marsh, Adam Voges, all kinds of stuff. And listen carefully to this reply, because Danish sent this. He said, "I was excited to hear my number come up. Really interesting to hear how one number can resonate through history. Especially enjoyed hearing of Callis's 130s. Lamentably, none of your answers were what I had in mind. And not being a fan of verbosity, my clue is as follows. Firsts, Danish." Now, if you take the first letter of each of those sentences, it spells the word Ireland. I-R-E-L-A-N-D. I might have missed out the N. There was an N1 in there, but I obviously haven't copied it across if anyone's listening really closely. So that told me that it was something to do with Ireland, and I didn't think it was about the fact that Paul Sterling, made 130 against Bangladesh in a losing effort, because that's the only time any Irish player has made 130 individually. But it is what Ireland as a team made in their very first innings in Test cricket. They got bowled out by Pakistan for 130. An innings that didn't start well. They were 4 for 7, then they were 5 for 36, then they were 8 for 73. Kevin O'Brien made 40, Gary Wilson 33 not out, and that got them up to 130. And after they were forced to follow on, it came together. KOB made the ton, 118. Stuart Thompson made a 50. Ed Joyce made 43 up the top. They cumulatively put a score together, set Pakistan 160, and took 5 wickets on the way. And for a while there, it almost looked like they were going to pull off the miracle follow-on, win their first ever test match. They gave it a pretty good shift starting from 130.
Yeah, it was such an exciting last couple of days of that test when Kevin got going, and after he dug them out of the hole with Gary Wilson, who retired a couple of weeks ago, actually, Gary Wilson from international cricket, and Kevin O'Brien's finished up in the 50-over stuff, but still a T20 player. But yeah, when Tim Murtagh took three wickets in a hurry with Pakistan chasing 160, you're thinking, gee, this is going to be one of the great boil overs after Pakistan had that huge first innings lead. But unfortunately, it wasn't to be. But yeah, hopefully it won't be too long before we're all tuned in to more test cricket at Malahide.
Our next revisit is from Lara Killick, the $3.28, where, I mean, Adam, I thought you'd absolutely smashed this. It was a five for, it was the top of the leaderboard, and you came up with Bert Ironmonger's 7 for 23, in which he was the oldest player to take a five-wicket haul, his first five-wicket career haul. 3.28 was the average at which he took those 7 wickets, if you divide that across 7 for 23. Lara said, love what you did with the place. Love what you've done with it. This is great. You vastly overestimated my mathematical skills. And your answer is far more cerebral than I could ever have achieved or intended. I'm inclined to lie to you and say that you nailed it. So should you want that to be the truth, ignore what follows. But if you don't want it to be the truth, here are some second and third clues. Well, once we knew there was more to come, you had to look into it, Adam. The clue says, strictly speaking, this number is an average, but not one that would appear in a stats list. The unique fifer in the original clue refers to the number of male cricketers to have achieved this feat and therefore to be on the leaderboard.
Okay. Well, this is an unusual answer and one that I'm really glad that we've tapped into. Five male cricketers have appeared on Strictly Come Dancing. Thus the clue. Strictly speaking, at the top there from Lara. Mm-hmm. Two have won it, Darren Goff and then Mark mm-hmm. Ramprakash. I think Ramps is perhaps most well known for the fact that, I mean, for example, Rach knows all the cricketers that have been on Strictly far more than she knows them for their mm-hmm. for their cricketing. She knows a lot about Mark Ramprakash's hips and all the rest of it, but wouldn't have a clue mm-hmm. that he made 100 hundreds. So they are the unique fifer, those five. And in terms of the number, 3.28, 32.8 was Mark Ramprakash's average score across the competition, which is the highest of the lot of the five that played along on Strictly at different times. So I'm sure it won't be long before there's a sixth. Maybe the sixth cricketer that's on there should be a woman. In fact, it definitely should be a woman. So who would be the England player who's likely to retire next, who's got a Catherine Brunt? Catherine Brunt on Strictly, bring it on. I'm sure she'd love to do it.
Mm.
That would be something.
I mean, you know, she's a good mover. She's she's got the upper body strength as well. Could do some of the lifts and throws and whatnot.
Quite possibly. And if it's to be a bloke, the last cricketer that was on there was Swanee, wasn't it? Back in, I suppose it would have been about 2018, 2019, something like that. It might be a while before there's another sort of high profile enough English cricketer. I don't sort of see Alistair Cook doing it. Doesn't really strike me as the kind of guy who's going to end up doing variety television. Maybe at a pinch, Joe Root might do it when he's finished up. Maybe, possibly. Mm-hmm. But he's got a way to go yet. So
maybe they'd get Joss Butler in there if they could, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Boyish, again, blonde, good looks.
I guess they're both 30, aren't they? So they might be a few years away from being relevant. But maybe Jimmy? Maybe Jimmy. Jimmy works for the BBC, of course, anyway, on radio. Mm-hmm. So he might be the kind of guy who would go on Strictly. Watch this space.
Is he too grumpy to dance? That's the burning question.
He likes music. I had a conversation with Jimmy last year about gigs, and we realised quickly that we've both been at the same show when they lost the Perth Test match in 2010. So England lose in 3 days, which means that they get a couple of days off. And on that Sunday, I mean, I was going to be there for days, I think it was 2, 3, 4 and 5, something like that. It might have been over early on the fourth day, actually. It was a Sunday morning. And that meant on the Sunday evening, Jimmy and a couple of others went to watch Muse play at Claremont Football Ground, and I was there as well. It was an amazing gig before jumping on a plane and heading back to Canberra. So, and you know, he likes his indie music of a certain era. So in turn, I'm going to assume that, you know, he knows a thing or two mm-hmm. about dancing, and yeah, get him on there.
So that's the 3.28 for Lara Killick is the 32.8 that Mark Ramprakash averaged across the competition. And it is very England batting areas that the guy averaging 32.8 was also the top of the pops as far as the contenders went.
Well, what was his test average, Ramps? I mean, I might just quickly look that up. That, it could be, I mean, I don't know.
I reckon it'd be about the same, wouldn't it?
Well, it might be a fraction lower than that, just given the way he was in, out, never got a chance to be a consistent player for England. Yeah, 27.3 is what he averaged at test level. Of course, at first class level, that advances to 53 with 114 centuries and 147 other scores above 50. 35,659 runs, if you don't mind, in a career that spanned 1987 till 2012.
Right. So the last revisit is from Dara O'Donovan. $8.75. Adam was talking about Gus Fraser taking 8 for 75. Dara says, and I like this clue now that I've worked out what the answer is, always a pleasure to be listening along and hear your own nerd pledge come up. Angus Fraser, pitch invasions at the 99 World Cup and Buddy's 100th goal at Docklands all intersected neatly with my own interests. But that was not what my pledge referred to. A little oddly, the hint for another pledge, which was waiting, also applies to mine. So we're either both onto the same obscure stat or that's quite a coincidence. In fact, I think they must be. I think these two, now that I think about it, this is Bob Tronson, who also had 875. Mm. I think this must be the same answer for both now that I put these together. Dara says, mine is nothing to do with runouts in any case. My last pledge related to Irish cricket. So does this, but in a different style, and Jeff's literary background might help. Well, a laydown mazair with that clue, Dara. Samuel Beckett, Nobel Prize winner for literature in 1969, the author of Waiting for Godot, also played first-class cricket. Played two first-class matches for Trinity College in Dublin in the 30s. He batted at 8 and 9 in his first game. He was a left-handed opener in the second. He bowled some left-arm stuff as well. Never took a first-class wicket. Made 36 runs in his 4 first-class hits, which works out with 4 dismissals to an average of 8.75, which is the answer for Dara O'Donovan, and I'm sure the answer for Bob Tronson, whose clue was simply the word waiting. Waiting for Godot, 8.75.
We started the show by pondering whether we could get Jerry O'Connell to join us on the cricket field at some stage. Whenever I think of sliders, I think of Quantum Leap, where the main character is Dr. Sam Beckett, played by Scott Bakula, theorising that one could time travel through his own lifetime. Dr. Samuel Beckett stepped into the Quantum Leap Accelerator and vanished. He awoke to find himself trapped in the past, facing mirror images that were not his own, and driven by an unknown force to change history for the better. His only guide in his journey is Al, an observer from his own time who appears in a form of a hologram who only Sam can see and hear. And so Dr. Beckett finds himself leaping from sight to sight, I think, striving to put right what once went wrong and hoping each time that his next leap will be the leap home. Maybe we can get Scott Bakula to play. That's what I'm trying to say. Jerry O'Connell and the man that played Sam Beckett could join us on the cricket field at LA 2028.
And if Samuel Beckett could get a first-class page on Cricket Archive, I'm sure we can get first-class status for this smokers v non-smokers style and get Jerry O'Connell a first-class career. Why not? Why not?
Jerry O'Connell, confirmation. Jerry O'Connell and Scott Bakula to get Crick Info pages, please.
If you were trying to calculate Scott Bakula's stats, then that would make you Count Bakula.
Okay. Hmm. We're just going to have to play on. Confirmations. Yeah, okay. Confirmations.
The 298 from Dom Philp, that was indeed the Dion Nash game at the Gabba when he played the scoop. Dom says, bloody hell, I can't believe you nailed it. First time. Amazing areas. Every reason I chose the number was mentioned in the summary. Every detail is crystal clear in my mind. And you did the match justice, Adam. I genuinely got goosebumps listening. Nostalgia mania is running wild. Well done.
I'm so glad that came together. Purely coincidental that we had those string of New Zealand one-day scores in Australia, neutral games in the Tri-Series. A lot of great feedback on Discord and on the Patreon page around our campaign to get the Tri-Series back. So thank you, Dom Philp, for being part of that. Matt Keane, we revisited his 375 or his 375 on Story Time.
Well, we got this right later. So I reckon Matt's replied to us doing this the first time and then we came back to it the subsequent week, I think, and got this last detail, which is that the 375 is the 3 for 75 that Ian Botham took when he obtained the test wicket-taking record when he went to 356 test wickets. So
yeah,
we ended up there eventually, I think. So Matt, if you haven't found that other app. We did pin it down in the end.
273 was Brian Stratford. Jeff, you said that was the number of wickets that Trent Johnston took for Ireland across God knows how many different statistical categories. Brian said, well done, you are right. And good to know the explanation as to how the number was reached, even if it might actually be wrong. I didn't know the bus story, Adam, and why he ended up in Ireland. As a legend of Irish cricket, it'd be great if you can get him on the show in the future. Great work, etc. I agree. We should get Trent on, and I don't imagine it'd be particularly hard for us to get him on either, because he's still floating around, coaching on the circuit, does a bit of media. So let's add him to the list, Jeff.
Excellent. Why not? Stuart Duncan says a 178 is correct in that I think I spoke about Graham Hicks 178. Stuart says he was thinking of it as a batting number and that he'd heard growing up that Graham Hick had made a big 100 in India but never seen it until finding it on YouTube, which is helping a lot of us get reconnect with old cricket. God bless that medium. Fun to watch too, says Stuart, coming in at 58 for 4 and getting England to 347. Crick Info tells me that Graham Hick's performance in this match puts him 25th on the list of those with the most runs in a losing men's test match.
That's very nerd pledge areas, that kind of list, I reckon. Yeah. Thank you, Stuart. 462, Sean Barry. I talked about John F. Reid, but I didn't know why it was 462. So John Fulton Reid passed away last year, a great of New Zealand cricket through the late 70s and early 80s. Now, initially, I didn't know what the 462 was, and Sean said, why didn't you look at his Crick Info page? And I have to say, that's a bloody good question. Why didn't I? His test batting average is 46.28. I mean, in fairness, I think I would have seen that and immediately discounted it because I would have rounded up to 46.3. But still, on the page it reads. So yeah. I can see why in my brain I would have ruled it out, but it did go awfully close. Originally, I was thinking about what Sean had said in relation to a Reid innings he'd witnessed in the Plunkett Shield at the Basin, and I went through every single innings that he'd played there, and none of them had anything to do with 462, and I was bewildered. But he, in lieu of the fact that there is no innings from the Plunkett Shield, Sean thinks that it might have been the three-day comp called the Shell Trophy. It probably wasn't a ton. It just became my own memory. But I remember sitting across the terraces below the Vance stand and watching him straight drive Wellington folk hero Ewan Charlie Chatfield to the fence repeatedly. That's a nice memory. Whether it was 100 or not, whether it was the Plunkett Shield or not, the fact that Sean has that moment with the late John Reid's a lovely thing.
That's a bit of Vance joy for you, Sean Barry. And yeah, I'm sure, Adam, the 462 was you looking for it in the scorecards of these esoteric New Zealand first-class matches and just not looking at his top-line career stats. And fair enough, because that's where you thought it was.
Yeah, well, when you mentioned earlier in the show that we treat this like a job and we spend a lot of time preparing Nerd Pledge each week, and which is why it'd be nice for those who listen to also be part of what we're doing. That's what I'm saying. That's what becomes work, scrolling through every first-class scorecard from John Fulton Reid's career in New Zealand. That's what we do.
Well, speaking of looking too hard for it, Rory Seymour's 411, which was about the West Wing and cricket, where I was very pleased that I landed on the fact that the cricket clip on YouTube has 411,000 views, or it did at the point that I saw it. It was not, in fact, that number. You mentioned on that episode, you said maybe it's from season 4, episode 11, but it wasn't.
I did.
But in season 4, episode 11, there's the other cricket bit in the West Wing where they talk about making friends with a cricket enthusiast on Bermuda who somehow gets people onto a scam by the CIA or something like that. It's what is it? Danny Concannon and CJ. I haven't watched the West Wing. This is
No. You're right. But basically, what happened was that the interaction between Danny, who's a journalist, and CJ, who's the press secretary, when he first gets back and he's asleep on her sofa, being Christmas, he's come home for Christmas. It's a lovely scene, but after they exchange pleasantries and they had a fling earlier in the show and they end up getting married in season 7, he kind of goes, now, there's his story. I've heard it from a guy in Bermuda and all the rest of it. And I just assumed that episode 11 from season 4 was only related to the Toby storyline with his father, but I forgot that the B plot was Danny coming back, and thus this is when the whole thing started around the assassination from season 3, which was nicely covered up by the White House. But because Danny gets the little inside scoop on this bit of the story, the whole thing unravels, and it all begins there in season 4, episode 11. A nice way back to the game.
It's all because a guy mysteriously took his cricket bat to work, and only his cricket bat, and then left it there in his locker at work. Why would you ever take your cricket bat to work? You're just going to have a net in the hallway, like on your lunch break? Like, come off it, even in Bermuda.
And Rory also goes on to say that, I think the fact that you guys had a 5-minute chat about cricket and the West Wing shows that the final word is the perfect corner of the internet for me. That was confirmed when Adam was referencing lyrics from my favourite band, The National, on last week's episode. Keep up the good work, and he's going to pledge again. So thank you, Rory.
What's the line about, I was carried from Ohio on a swarm of bees? I'm like, Jesus Christ, you're some sort of freakish bee king who's just coming to like wreak bee related revenge on your enemies. Don't piss off the National. They will make you sad, not just with their music. All right, that's it. That's the show. That's story time this week. That's how it works. If you want to be part of it, patreon.com/thefinalword. Send us a number. We'll add it to our list. Thank you to Brick Lane for being the refreshing beer company that helps support this show. Thanks to The Guardian as well for having Adam on a panel. Make sure you have a look at the link for that and see if you want to sign up for it, if that time zone seems like it all fit for you. The Final Word is part of the Bad Producer Podcast Network. It is edited by Dave Collins, who is creatively nicknamed DC. Thanks, DC. And it's done by me and Adam Collins. No relation. That's it for us. We'll be back midweek with the weekly show.
And spend some time, if you're here, jump on the Discord channel. It's popping. Jeff, I think we've got more than 100 people on there at the moment, don't we? So if you want to continue the conversation through the weekend with Jeff and myself and everyone else, it's simply a case of getting the link either from the Patreon email, DMing Jeff or me, or linking it yourself between Patreon and Discord. It's all fairly straightforward.
Alrighty. Weekly show will be out on Wednesday on this coming week. Story time on Saturday. And we shall get back in your ears then.
Have a nice weekend. I had to go about it.